Kind of think of the situation that we're in like this. Here is a situation where a man has suffered as much shock and grief as a human being can experience. The loss of things and livelihood, the loss of loved ones and relationship with them, the loss of health, and now the very core of his being is challenged. That is what he believes about God. All of that has gone on. And now what the pattern of things in this book is, here will be Job in his terrible agony and hurt. And Job expresses from the innermost being the struggle that he's going through here. But here are his friends sitting close by. And while Job has merely said to God how he feels, why, not only why has this happened to me, but why can't I die? Why was I even born? Well, then his friends think that calls for an answer, not for understanding, not just for their presence, but for an answer. And so they will say to Job, we've seen Eliphaz say this, man generally reaps what he sows, and in fact it was revealed to me that in a vision that that's how God works. And what happens then is that Job will first, and there will be generally in his answers two chapters, or in some cases three. And of course, he doesn't say, this is chapter one of my response, and then chapter two. But what he does is to say, first off, he will reply to his friend, and then Job will again say, will state his feelings or his questions or his struggles to God. And then, as if still not to have learned, the next friend will do the same thing. And Job will respond first to the friend, and then he will go a little farther. He goes a little farther each time in his conversation with God. And that happens. We're in the first cycle of those things right now as we've been reading along. And what has happened is that Job's second friend, Bildad, has responded, and he claims that God doesn't pervert justice. So if Job will confess whatever's been amiss in his children's life or in his, then God will certainly restore him, and his life will then be a glowing example of prosperity and joy. The reason Job is in this kind of agony is the assumption that always has been that God unfailingly deals with people based on their actions in this life. And that gives him agony over what he's lost. But even worse, when his friends begin to respond to his statements about how he's feeling, they assume that if he will be right with God, this will all be brought back to him again, and that it can't be for any other reason. So, Job's struggles are deepened, which is, after all, what the enemy wants to happen. Remember that, Brother Feeney?
I missed maybe the first class. Did you establish or try to what era of the Bible is,
yes,
the place in.
Try to is the right word. We tried to point out that this is set, or seems to be set, in the patriarchal age, and that God deals with Job not only as a father, but as a priest in that way. At least it seems to me, as the head of the house, that was the case. And you see Job offering the sacrifices.
And how ironic it is that his life will fit into all three categories.
Yes, it does.
The Mosaic, patriarchal, or the Christian.
Yes, because it is a human problem. And all three of the ages, the Old Testament prophets, and then in the New Testament with a book like James, for example, Job's example is used as for the human condition. All right, where we are now is that Job has said, if there were an umpire between God and myself, it would be shown that I have not done anything deserving of this kind of loss and agony and suffering. Job's not claiming to be completely perfect, but he is saying, if God does deal with people based only on what they've done, then whatever else has happened in my life, I know I haven't done things that deserve this kind of agony. That's kind of where we are. And in chapter 10 now, Job turns again from responding to Bildad, his friend, and restates how he's feeling about God. I think that this chapter is one of the darkest of this book. I think the lowest points of despair are possibly struck in this chapter. And I'd like to call your attention to some of what he says about God. We'll not try to read it verse by verse, but I'd like to know what you think of some of what he says. What Job says, and this is a statement that he's repeated three times or so at least already, I loathe my life, chapter 10, verse 1. And this, by the way, is what gives his friend a problem. This doesn't sound right to them. So Job says, I'm going to go ahead and give free utterance to my complaint. And this is the key thing for us to understand. His complaint is spoken in the bitterness of his soul here, not in the brightness of intellectual research and thought, an argument. This is a complaint. There are places in Scripture that fit this category of conversation with God. Some of the Psalms are called laments. What does a lament do? Is it meant to be a doctrinal argument? Is it
sorrow?
It expresses sorrow and agony. It lets God hear. It lets God hear the struggles and the question that an honest human being goes through. Does God express anger or resentment toward laments? No, he doesn't. This is a part of the problem Job's friends are having, is that they think relationship with God means everything is almost syrupy sweet, and that all of life turns out, we call it a bed of roses sometimes. If you're right with him, you'll be healthy and wealthy, and I can't think of another word that rhymes with that, but you get the idea that everything will be, you know. And that's the thought. And what Job says is, I want to, my complaint, it has to be, I have to say it. Verse 2, what's he asking of God in verse 2, chapter 10? What's the thing that is giving Job the most trouble at this point?
Why?
Why? All right, let me know why you contend against me. What is he assuming there that's not really happening, but Job doesn't know this?
What did I do?
All right, that's part of it.
Yeah.
All right, why are you contending with me? Who was really contending with him, even through his friends?
Satan
was, all right? And that's the part of this that Job doesn't see at this point. And what he asks God, he assumes that for the moment that everything that happens is God's doing. Is that really so? Are there things that happen in life that are not God's doing? Yes, there are. And Job assumes here that, does it seem good to you to oppress and despise the work of your hands and favor the designs of the wicked? There's the point. Does this seem right to you, God? Do you see like a man, verse 4, maybe your days are running out and you have to settle my iniquity now while there's time, even though you know that I'm not guilty and that nobody can deliver me out of your hands? These are statements to me that have the sound of a man who has been sitting on the heap of ashes, struggling with what he's going through, and trying to think of why, and he is just saying every possibility that he's been able to conceive of in his mind. And sometimes that's what we go through. Notice the thing that bothers Job is that he can think about his life and he can see the hand of God's providence, which has blessed him and preserved him at so many occasions. And now he wonders why God would do all of those things to care for me and bless me and keep me in the past and now do this to me. I want you to see that that's the point, verses 10 and following here. If you notice as we look at, did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? What a way to think of forming a person. You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. By the way, that statement corresponds with Psalm 139 about God forming us even in the prenatal condition. You granted me life and steadfast love. Your care has preserved me, my spirit. Now look at verse 12. What's he say there? This may get translated in different ways in one key place here. He wants to know where God is in things now. Verse 12. What's the purpose of all of this? I think is, in fact, the ESV translated, yet these things you hid in your heart, I know that this was your purpose. Now what he says in the next few verses, 14 through 17, is, I'm going to supply the I feel like, because I think that's what's being said. I feel like that if I sin, you're watching me and you won't let it go. And I feel like if I'm guilty, then woe to me. And I feel like that if I was not guilty, then even then I couldn't lift up my head in honor, because you wouldn't allow it. I'd be filled with disgrace for that. And then verse 16, if my head were lifted up, and that's meaning the being lifted up means to be honored or to come out of this agony or darkness he's going in, then you'd hunt me like a lion and work wonders against me. And then you'd bring out other witnesses against me and so on. Do you see what he's getting at? All his friends are saying, if, Job, if you would straighten out things with God, then everything would be rosy, peachy again in your life. Job is saying, it looks to me like that there's nothing I can do in this situation that would turn this around. The helplessness part of it is the big issue. And then he turns in verse 18 and following, a restatement partly to what he said in chapter 3. Why'd you bring me out from the womb? And then verse 19, he's saying, it seems to me like, I wish the grave had been my first and only cradle. You guys see that? Whereas though I'd not been carried from the womb to the grave. And he wishes it could have been that way. Since it's not, now then, verse 20, he wishes that since his days are few because of this illness, that God would cease laying more on him and leave him alone so that he could find a little cheer before he goes to the valley of deep darkness. You see that in verses 20 through 22? That's, folks, that is a lament of laments there. And if you look at what he's saying here, and this is why I say that this is one of the darkest spots in this book. He says, if you notice in outlining the chapter here, He's saying, first, there's no one to deliver. No one can change God's mind about this, so there's no one to deliver me. And then he says, in verse, in the next section here, there's no purpose to this. There's no guiding principle that I can see through all of this. And then he says, there's nothing I can do in this situation to correct it or redeem it or to change my standing in all of this. And therefore, he says that the best I can hope for is a little room before I die to catch my breath. All right. Now, has he, in saying this, done any wrong to any other human being? Has he sinned against God in saying this? Has he insulted his friends in saying this? I think the most that we can say about this is that he has maybe assumed some things about God's role in this that are not so. Right?
That's where his sin will come.
That's where his sin will come. And that's where he'll finally lay his hand over his mouth and repent of having said things that were over his head, having gotten in over his head in a way. But at this point, though, he is simply stating the despair and the agony. Now, to you, what, out of chapter 10, what statement of Job strikes you as being the most human or the most touching, the most understandable?
Wish he'd never been born.
All right. That wish that he's having, that has to assume that I and the world would have been better off if I had not been born. Yeah. Anybody else? I think the inability to see any purpose in it is the thing that touches me. You granted me life. You gave me your care. Now, what's your purpose in all of this? That's a big question about life that comes up. Now, are there answers? What would a friend do? What should a friend do when he is, let me say it this way. If you were a friend of Job and you knew his background and his total life story, what would have been the appropriate thing for you to think in view of what he says here? Yes.
Job, do you trust God?
All right. All right. That's the question, I think, here. I'm thinking to myself here, one appropriate thing to do would be to think to myself, you know, I know Job. And I know Job's heart, and I know what Job believes. And I know that Job is not really saying here that intellectually he's concluded that he should not have been born. In other words, sometimes a friend will listen and knowing who you are, not conclude that that's really the deep conviction of your life, that it's what you're going through at that moment. You see what I'm getting at? And what the friend does in that situation is then not to out-argue a Job, but to support his trust in God and to assume the best of him in that way in the middle of this agony. Now, what does happen, though, in chapter 11 is the third friend has been listening to this. So we're now down to this, it's happened this way now, this being Job over here, And now the third friend takes this as a direct challenge against the greatness and the goodness of God that has to be answered. The gauntlet has been thrown down, and therefore Job must be corrected. So look at chapter 11, beginning at verse 1. Zophar the Naamathite, he believes that a multitude of words, a man full of talk, babble, and mocking has to be answered. Now, what problem do you see in verses 2 and 3 about Zophar's view of what Job has said?
Doesn't show any sense of understanding of Job's true heart. It's just he's putting it back on Job as,
all right,
you know, what kind of person do you think you are that say those things and not deserve them?
All right. The mistake he makes is that to forget that Job's words are about what Job is suffering, Zophar thinks that Job's words are about God. And of course, Job has said some things about God, but he said them in the middle of his suffering. And he said some things that he needed to be gentled about, and God will do it later on. But it's not because Job has been trying to mock or babble or that kind of thing. Zophar thinks, at the end of verse 3, that a man like Job has got to be shamed. Do you see that? Here's what he says about Job, verses 4 through 6. Jan, do you mind to read those verses?
For you have said, my teaching is pure, and I am innocent in your eyes. But would that God might speak and open his lips against you and show you the secrets of wisdom, for sound wisdom has two sides. Know then that God forgets a part of your iniquity.
All right. Now, Zophar has understood Job to say, my doctrine is pure and I am clean in God's eyes. Is that exactly what Job has said in your opinion?
No.
All right, some of you are saying, what have you understood him to be saying?
I've not done anything bad enough for this kind of punishment.
Right.
I've tried really hard to do what I was supposed to do, you know, but I haven't done anything this bad.
And why?
And why, yes. I've understood Job to be saying, why has this happened? And one other part of it that we haven't mentioned is, I've understood Job to be saying, I have seen people completely leave God out and turn totally to wickedness and have things a lot better than I've had it right now. That's the kind of the struggle that Job has been saying. And Zophar says, if God would, Job has been calling out for an umpire between himself and God, chapter 9 and verse 33. He wants God to answer him. And Zophar says, if God would speak, verse 5, then his wisdom, he would let you see that there is wisdom behind what you're going through that you haven't even dreamt of yet. You would find out that God is wise in what he's doing. Of course, Job does find that out, but in a different way than what Zophar means. The problem is the conclusion that Zophar draws, verse 6. What does he conclude about Job's circumstance?
Your sin is so bad that you deserve a whole lot worse than
them. All right. Now, we've gone from, generally speaking, a man reaps what he sows, to, if you would, God doesn't pervert justice, so if you'd turn around, he'd bless your life. To now, the truth is, God is exacting from you less than you deserve. All right, now, how does that help Job? All right. What he's done is to have concluded something about Job's character that's gotten harder more critical as this book has gone along. Job's sayings about his agony have driven Zophar to the conclusion that there really is some terrible defect in Job, which God is exacting. And Zophar's view of God is he exacts from people what they owe, but he's merciful in that he doesn't exact as much as they owe. The problem, again, is no room is left for any force to be at work other than God. And no sympathy is expressed here to the kind of man or for the kind of man Job has been. And look at the reasoning as it unfolds, verse 7 and following. He offers now a view of the knowledge and wisdom of God, which says, Job, nobody, and including you, is in a position to know everything about what God knows and what God is doing. Verse 7, can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It's higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Is all that true? It's all true about God. The problem is in the conclusion reached about Job. Verse 11, God knows a worthless man. He sees iniquity. The idea being that God is aware of Job and that's why this is happening. Now, verse 13 and following draws the conclusion. Zophar's premise is, Job, God is exacting less than you deserve. His reasoning is, God knows more than you know. And his advice is, prepare your heart and God will restore your life. Look at verse 13 and following here. Randy, do you mind to read a little bit there? 13 through 15, please.
If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away, and do not let wickedness dwell in your tent. Then indeed, you could lift up your face without moral defect, and you would be steadfast and not fear.
All right, and he goes ahead to describe how you'll forget your misery, your life will be brighter than noonday, you'll feel secure, there'll be hope, you'll lie down without fear, and people will court your favor, and you won't be out here on the ash heap by yourself anymore. That is the thought. Now, the question that we have to ask is, where did Zophar go wrong in his advice? To prepare your heart, to, if iniquity is in your hand, to put it away. All that's, of course, things that any of us should do. The problem is in verse 15. What mistake is Zophar making here? All right, he's assuming again that Job was not steadfast to begin with. He also is offering advice to a man who was not seeking advice but understanding. That puts this whole discussion on shaky ground. And then thirdly, Zophar is saying you can't know all of God's knowledge and everything that God is knowing, but then Zophar is speaking like he does know. Okay, Monty? It
reminds me a lot of, in this day and age, talking to people about various doctrines, they all have beliefs, thoughts, and ideas. It seems to me like he's coming from
I want to gently bring it back to one context. This is in the context of why this is happening to a man. And this is, I think, the mistake that Zophar is making is that he is making this a doctrinal matter. He's arguing doctrinally, and that's not what really is at stake here. What's at stake is a man. And in the situation that where he is, just think about it this way with me. Zophar is arguing, verse 7 and following, nobody can find out the deep things of God, what God is knowing, what God is doing. And then he turns right around and says, Job, I know what God is doing. This is what's happening to you, and this is what he would do if you do what I think you should. Brother Feeney.
The thinking in those days when this was written was, if God blesses you with things and he takes it away, there has to be sin.
That's right.
And so they have sat there those 7 days, and Job can't think of a thing.
Yeah.
I can think of several things in my case.
I couldn't, mine too.
All of us could.
Yes.
But Job couldn't. And so he's holding on to his integrity that you've been talking about. And these friends are not willing to let that ride.
Yeah, and they're not willing to try to listen to him and support him in his struggle. And what they think then gets used to make it worse. If you see what we're getting at with that. Zophar, in some ways, with each round of conversation, the charges against Job have gotten worse, and they certainly do here. Okay, Russ?
And if, in their eyes, they think that Job is accusing God wrongly, and that he is taking a position against God, then you got to have a little respect for the fact that they are trying to defend God's honor,
well,
if you please.
They are there.
I mean, they're
still there. Yes. They're still there, and they're still talking with him. At the end, though, God's going to say, Job has spoken rightly of me, and you haven't. They're going to say that, and that will be part of this story. Is that the first one? All right. I want to, before we get away, just to ask you to notice the first part of chapter 12. If chapter 10 is the darkest moment in Job, chapter 12 is the most sarcastic in Job. Job says, no doubt you're the people, and wisdom will die with you. You can hear, this is a place where you can hear the tone of voice, can't you? And then listen to him. There's something really touching about this. But I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? He thinks they are giving him trite answers about a difficult, complicated situation in his life. And look at how he has said how he is feeling about what he's struggling with. They've answered him. Here's how Job feels about their answers. I am a laughing stock to my friends. Why would he think that?
Well, they can. I mean, I don't know, but to me, it's here he's worshipped God and he's tried to be good, and what's happened to him. Now look at other people who haven't, and they may just be making fun of him having put so much stock into God all that time.
He may not be saying that they're actually laughing at him. He may be saying that when they begin to bring accusations against him, he feels like they are taking some delight in his agony and his downfall. A great man, highly respected, is being kind of brought down. And human envy and jealousy can cause that, but what they've said makes him feel like that somehow or another they take some delight in his agony. Notice that he argues again in verse 4 for his standing as a just and blameless man. In other words, he still is asserting his integrity in verse 4. In verse 5, he says, in the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. What is he saying?
He's
My paraphrase, it is easy to have all the answers about people who are hurting when you are comfortable. I think that's what he's getting at. It's easy to think when you are at ease. It's easy to look at another person who is struggling and say, "Well, it's his own fault. This is why it's happening," or whatever. But Job says, "The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure." Verse six. So things don't always operate just on this system. You put a nickel in, you get a nickel's worth out. When you're talking about the walk with God and the way we live in the circumstances of this world. All right. What do we learn from Job's friend Zophar? We learned a little bit about the need for humility in this situation. We learned from Job that sometimes when you're hurting, you say things that you don't really believe. And we learned in the third place something about God, that he waits and lets these things go on. And remains God, Brother Feeney.
I have learned that there's some that shouldn't go visit.
Yes. Yes. We talked about that a little bit last week, but for all of us who do visit, we learn here that if there's ever a place to, as James says, be swift to hear and slow to speak, it is then. And when you do speak, resist the temptation right then to explain things. There may be a better day to get into some discussions about those matters, but right then may not be the time. It may be time to say that, to listen and just be there. It might be the time to help in some practical way. Can I help with something to eat or something like that?
Things will get better.
Right. It may be the time to pray quietly within yourself for that person even.
Yeah, but he keeps sitting on that ash heap.
He does. And the reason is because...
Dust yourself off. Do something.
Yeah, well, the reason is, though, the sores are not gone, Les. There's no medicine, nothing to do but to scrape these pus-filled sores with pots. The devil is still laying it on him. That's the point here. And that's why this goes on like it does. It's not as hopeless as these chapters say. Wait till you read chapter 13. I hope you will in order to get ready for next week. Thanks for being with us today.